Think all the young kids are in families that are sick this morning, so unless some of y'all feel real young, we won't have kids class. We're going to be in Luke, book of Luke, chapter 22, verses 1 to 6. We'll read our text to begin with, Luke chapter 22, verses 1 to 6. Now the feast of unleavened bread drew nigh, which is called the Passover. And the chief priests and scribes sought how they might kill him, for they feared the people. Then entered Satan into Judas, surnamed Iscariot, being one of the 12. And he went his way and communed with the chief priests and captains how he might betray him unto them. And they were glad and covenant to give him money. And he promised and sought opportunity to betray him unto them in the absence of the multitude. These first six verses. Back in about 1990, I'm not sure of the year, 88 to 90, I was presented with an opportunity to supposedly make some pretty decent money for little of no effort, and always one to get excited about something like that. I checked it out, and it was to plant a bunch of grapevines and have a grape vineyard. And I ended up with 125 seedless grape, Venus variety grapevines, put them out. The selling point was that you just can't kill the things. They just, you know, will come back and come back and come back and grow. And all you got to do is stick a bucket out there and they'll fall in the bucket, I guess, you know, just nothing to it. So I did. Put up the end post, put two wires down through there to train the vines on, and the cuttings is just a cutting, well, about that long or that long, just as long as it has four nodes on it. You just cut it off a vine, stick it in the ground, and here it goes. It just starts growing. So I did that. First year, or probably the second year, of as far as season-wise, we had a bunch of grapes and gave some of them away, made grape juice. We had 23 gallons of grape juice. That was really good, and it didn't last long because me and the boys got rid of it. But anyway, then something started happening, and black rot got into my grapes. And I wasn't wanting to spray them. I didn't want to spray a fungicide on them. I wanted everything to be natural and all this kind of stuff. And so I'd look at them, and if you ever saw one little bitty black dot about the end of a point of that a pencil might make, it's too late. And a few days, they're gone. You just eat them up. And so then I found out I either got to spray them, and that's work and all this, and I got downtrodden. I got discouraged that this was going to be a lot more, not what I thought it was going to be, going to be a lot of work. And I was going to have to spray them. And so I just let them go. And they were there two or three years. They would have grapes on them, and black rot would get on them. And I'd look at them, and I just hate looking out there at all those grapevines that I was absolutely doing nothing to or nothing about, and there they were. And my shop was there all this was at my house. And one day, me and the guys that worked for me, and Mark Daniel were probably 7 or 8 years old, I think, at the time, they were there working at the house on some cabinets and end up with 2 or 3 hours free, and just on a spur of the moment, I said, well, we're fixing to get rid of my grapes. So we took all the posts up, the wire down, hooked my truck chained to the base of each one of those vines where it went in the ground, yanked them all out and threw them away, got rid of everything there. And I was out of the grape business. Now, I tell you this for this reason, because something happened that I didn't anticipate happening. The next morning when I got up and came outside, when I walked out the front door, you're looking right at them. And the next morning I got up and went outside to go to work, and they were gone. And there was just this feeling of a burden lifted off of me, that I no longer had to worry about those grapes that I was doing nothing about. No longer had to have this guilty feeling of not doing what I ought to be doing with those grapes. It was over. I had cut my losses, you might say, and it was gone. And I felt free. Now, I want you to keep that thought in mind, because as we go through our text, we've read the text, and we're going to talk about that idea. And we're going to look at this text from the, not necessarily the eyes of five different persons, but kind of from their perspective, maybe. But let's go through and see. The first one is look from the eyes of God. And I'm going to, of course, include Jesus in this. God and Jesus. Let's talk about what their relationship is with this text, with Judas betraying Jesus. The New Testament lists Judas Iscariot as one of the 12 apostles. Jesus chose 12 apostles, and one of them was Judas Iscariot. He's named in all three lists. We see the list in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He's named in every one of them. He's listed last in every list. And there's a phrase there that kind of identifies him, Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed Jesus. So we see he was chosen by Jesus to be a disciple. In Psalm chapter 41, verse 9, which was written 1,000 years prior to the time Jesus was on earth, or thereabouts, 1,000 years earlier, that psalm is said to speak of Jesus' betrayer in Psalm 41, in verse 9. It talks about, my familiar friend has lifted up his heel against me. Jesus quotes that in John chapter 13 as applying to him and the betrayer. In Zechariah, which was chapter 11, which would have been 500 or 600 years prior to Jesus being on earth, it foretold the price of 30 pieces of silver and talks about the potter's field in connection with that 30 pieces of silver. So here are instances where the Bible tells us that there is knowledge, and God knows about all of this years and years before it ever happened. Jesus said in John chapter 6 that the betrayer was a devil from the beginning. This is in a year or so before Jesus is crucified. Jesus talks about the betrayer, someone who would betray him, and saying he was a devil from the beginning. Jesus told his disciples who it was that would betray him when he gave him the sop at the Last Supper there. Jesus also said it would have been better if this man had never been born. Now, if Jesus was walking every day with this betrayer in his midst, why didn't he ever pull him off to the side and say, look, you don't have a clue what you're doing. Why are you planning on doing this? Why are you going to do this? Don't do this. When the opportunity comes, don't do it. Redeem yourself. He never did that, did he? And here's the idea. It's hard to read through the Bible and to read through the New Testament and miss the idea that God and Jesus knew from the eternity past what was going on. In fact, it appears as if, and is the case, I believe, that God decreed not just who the betrayer would be, but that he would be betrayed, and that when and how and all of the details of it, how it would take place. And it looks like in the New Testament that Jesus makes sure his path is clear to follow through with what he's going to do. Now that's how it appears to me that Jesus and God are related to this incident. Secondly, let's look at the scribes. And in this group, the scribes, I would place the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Sanhedrin, the high priest, all of this group, and I'm just going to use the word scribes to talk about them. But these people want Jesus dead. It started out 3 years earlier when Jesus began his ministry that they just irritated him, or Jesus irritated them. Jesus would challenge their man-made laws that they would come up with, and they probably felt like he made them look like a fool in front of the common people that they were trying to lord over all of these things. And they didn't like him. They grew very quickly to have a dislike for Jesus because he was a threat to their authority over the common people. And as time went on, their dislike for Jesus only got worse and worse, and the pressure that they felt to do something about him became greater and greater. And in our text today, it is the week of the Passover. There's a great influx of people into Jerusalem from the surrounding areas for the Passover. A huge amount of people is in Jerusalem, finds themselves there for the Passover. And a lot of these people perhaps were hoping that they would see Jesus, or they were planning on seeing Jesus, or wanting to see Jesus, and here he was, and Jesus is being thronged every day with this multitude of people who adore him and are hoping that he is the Messiah that they hope he will be. And he's fixing at this time in their history, in this week perhaps, to declare himself and to overthrow the Romans and become the reigning Messiah forever and ever on the throne of David, as has been promised and prophesied. And the scribes see this, and it makes their desires or their hatred of Jesus just worse and worse, and they're at a point where it's just about to boil over, and they've got to do something. They are ready to do something. However, the Roman Empire has an increased military presence. Anytime there's a bunch of Jews get together, this many people in a group, there's always a potential for trouble, and so they have an increased presence there just to be ready just in case. We see things like that all the time. The scribes have tried to find fault with Jesus. Now, have you ever thought about this? If someone hated you, and they had the means to do what to use whatever means they wanted to or needed to find something wrong with you, to find the skeletons in your closet, how many of you would say they'll not find a thing? Anybody? No. All it takes for somebody to find something wrong with us is to look, to talk to our spouse, our children, or our neighbors, or our cousins, or our fellow workers. There's always something that's easily ready to be found about our character or our life, things that we have done wrong. Now, how hard do you think these scribes have tried to find something wrong with Jesus? Was it just a passing thing that they looked at one day? No. No, they are paying people to find that something dirt on him. And they haven't found anything. So then they try these little white lies or these little exaggerations or they take sort of things he said out of context or whatever. And that doesn't work. And they're at the point where they don't care what they have to do. They don't care what religious laws they have to break. They are ready to do anything that they can to kill him. To kill him. However, they don't want to go to jail themselves for doing it. So they've got to figure out a way that they can accomplish this without getting themselves in trouble with the Romans or without prompting a riot from all of these hundreds and thousands of people who are in Jerusalem that week that love Jesus. So they've got this dilemma. But as providence would have it, the solution to their problem just opens the door and walks in. It's Judas coming to offer them a deal. Look at the third group, the disciples. The disciples have expectations that Jesus is the Messiah. Now, what makes them think that is not so much that Jesus has said it, although if he hasn't said it, he's certainly implied it, but the miracles that Jesus has performed again and again and again just bolster their expectations that yes, this just very well may be the Messiah. And the further it goes, in a sense, the more evidence they have to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Occasionally they're puzzled a little bit by things that he says, especially talking about he must die and be raised the third day, and we've seen that multiple times as we went through the book of Luke and Matthew and Mark and John as well. And they don't understand what that's talking about. And he's told them and told them, but it's like there's a veil over their eyes and they just don't get it. Plus, they have this problem of wanting to be high up on his staff, wanting to be the vice president, wanting to be the attorney general or something. If Jesus is the Messiah and Jesus chose us 12, what did he choose us for? To shine his shoes? I don't think so. We're expecting he chose us to be right up there with him at his right hand and his left hand. So there's always this little bit of jockeying among themselves for positions in this kingdom that they're waiting for that Jesus is going to set up. They seem to be oblivious to the fact that in their midst there is someone that is a devil. Someone whose heart is really not in this. And you could ask them who it is, and it seems like they don't have a clue who it might be. Are they that lacking in discernment? Perhaps so. And perhaps it may be that there's enough similarity between that person and them that it could kind of look like any of us, you know. It's not just real. Speak highly of your spiritual character to want to be the greatest among us, is it? No. It's hard to read through this, and I always wonder and hope that these disciples aren't listening to us in heaven and hearing me talk about them, because they're people just like I am, just like you are. Right, we have sin. We have desires that are just not the greatest that we don't really want you to know about. We're not saints. And from my perspective, looking back at it, when Jesus was crucified, those 12 guys, or 11 by that point, seemed woefully unprepared to be left alone without Jesus. Does Jesus know that? Jesus is not worried about that. Jesus can bring them to maturity in a flash. Within about 40 days, they're grown up. He sees to it that they are. But here they are. And it seems to me, I've got it written down, Jesus seems to have to hang a sign around Judas's neck that says betrayer on it before they all understand who it is. And then they still miss it. You can read in John, 13, where they're talking about who is it that's going to betray us. And they said, is it me? Is it me? Is it me? And he said, it's whoever I dip the sop to and give to, that's the betrayer. And he dips it. From John 13, it reads like he dips it and hands it to Judas with these words. The thing that you're going to do, do it now. Do it soon. Do it quickly. And he gets up with the money bag, of course, carrying it with him, and he leaves. And they say, well, where's he going? What's going on? I guess he went to buy something. Jesus told him to go buy something for the meal. Just don't see it. And that very well could be because God has intentionally blinded their eyes for the moment. Let them not see that. The fourth group. And this is not a group, it's a person. Back side of your handout is Satan. We see in our text that it says Satan entered into Judas. Now, let me tell you my thoughts up front about this. I don't believe that Satan, he may do this, I don't know. If God wants it, that's certainly God's prerogative to do what he wants. But I don't know that Satan ever enters into somebody by force. I don't think Judas was kicking and screaming and fighting against Satan to be possessed by him. I think that Judas invites him in. Judas has made a fertile ground for Satan to take root in his life. And at the point where Satan desires to, he's all too willing to take advantage of that. But Satan, in times past, has tried to destroy Jesus, and I've used the word derail here, but I think it's more destroy than derail. Not get Jesus sidetracked, but to destroy him. We see that in Luke chapter 4, or back when we was in Luke chapter 4, the temptations of Jesus. My perspective on that was that Satan hated God. Satan wanted to destroy Jesus. And at the temptations there in the wilderness, that is exactly what he was wanting to do, was to destroy Jesus. I mean, rip him to shreds. Physically, literally. With all of the hatred that he could come and the violence that could come from his heart, he wanted to kill Jesus. But he could not. And the text back there said that he departed and went away till a more opportune time or for a season. I think he went away not in a huff, in rage. But he could not accomplish what he wanted to accomplish. And here, in this day, in our text, perhaps that more opportune time has come. It sure seems like it might have. Now, I was listening to John MacArthur's sermon on this passage a couple of weeks ago, and he appears to not believe that Satan was wanting Jesus to be dead and to be killed at the Passover at this time here. And I listened to what he said, and his idea that underlies this whole thing was that he believed Satan knew why Jesus came to earth to die for the sins of lost people. And for the life of me, I just can't see that. I'm not sure how much Satan knows. Now, if some of you can demonstrate to me that Satan knew why Jesus came, and I'm all ears. I'm ready to hear it. But I think when Satan comes to Judas, what Satan is wanting to do is to kill Jesus. He doesn't care when, he doesn't care how, he just wants him dead. Because he hates God, and he hates God's creation, and anything that God takes delight in, Satan wants to destroy. The Old Testament, we know, is full of types, it's full of pictures, it's full of illustrations, it's full of prophecies concerning the death of Jesus. Full of them. But Bible scholars will tell you that they cannot find one Hebrew scholar from before Christ's time who understood, for instance, Isaiah 53, understood the idea that the Messiah would die and suffer for the sins of the people. That's why especially Isaiah 53 was almost off limits to, they would skip over it, ignore it, because they did not understand how it seemed to be talking about the Messiah, but that this is not the picture of the Messiah that they were looking for. And if the Jewish rabbis and the Jewish teachers missed it, it seemed like everyone, human being, missed it. That's easy for us to see because we're looking back past its fulfillment. It's easy for us to see that. But apparently, they missed it. And I think Satan missed it too. It's hard, looking through the Old Testament and the New, to miss the idea that Satan's, for me at least, that Satan's existence can be summed up in one thing. He hates God, and he hates anything that God loves. Satan will take great delight in watching your soul burn in hell. He would take great delight and great joy in seeing my soul burn in hell. Yes, he is capable of disguising this hatred to get an inroad into your life. But in the end, when he sees he or thinks he is being successful and has been successful, it's hard for him not to show his delight. It's hard for him not to glory in what has taken place. And here, he has found a fertile soil in the heart of Judas. And he takes advantage of that. And Jesus is taken, betrayed by Judas and taken. And Satan is there watching the crucifixion. He's there watching the trials. And there has not been a happier day in his life. Satan understands about the Messiah, and he thinks he's killing the Messiah. He thinks he is ruining God's prince, the Messiah who would reign forever and ever and ever. He thinks he is tearing him down, and he's fixing to be killed. Satan is at the cross. He sees the crucifixion. He sees the death. But somehow, the fact that in the middle of the day it turns dark doesn't cause him to think, what's happening? The fact that there's an earthquake, that there are people walking down the streets that are supposed to be dead. If he could have went into the temple. And seen the veil torn from top to bottom. Somehow all of that went over his head. And he is there watching Christ die. Seeing him put in the tomb and the stone rolled over it. And I believe he very well could have been standing on top of the tomb or in front of the stone with his back to the stone, looking up to God and saying, "Ah! I have won. I am the victor." And last, we see Judas. Now, I want to walk through Judas's life, and I am telling you up front, I'm imagining what his life was like. We get enough details about Judas that we can read between the lines. I don't think that what I'm telling you is unreasonable, but I think Judas's life was something like this. Judas loved money. Judas wanted to be rich. Judas wanted power. Judas wanted fame. And he walked through every day of his life looking about, seeing how he might accumulate and possess what he wanted. And along the way, he heard about this guy named Jesus. Some people were saying that this guy might be the Messiah. Other people there were rumors that he had healed so-and-so and worked mighty miracles, and he'd heard all these things. As the days and weeks went by, he heard more and he heard more and he heard more, and by golly, one day, Jesus is there in front of him, and Jesus says, "Come and follow me." And for reasons unknown to himself, he did it. Maybe he was thinking, "What am I doing? Going and following this guy?" And then perhaps he thought, if this is the Messiah, and he's by now has witnessed perhaps some miracles, if he's who they say he's going to be, he's fixing to be the king and the right to reign over our nation of Israel forever and ever. And he's asking me to come and be with him? Here's an opportunity that's much better than a great vineyard that I had. Maybe this is my chance to be filthy rich. For people to look at me in awe as I walk down the street. And so he follows Jesus. Along the way, he manages somehow to be the bag keeper. To be the treasurer. To hold their money. You ever wonder where Jesus got any money? You can look at, I've got the verse down here, Luke chapter 8, verse 3, and see a good hint. There were some women, some of them whom Jesus had cast demons out of, had healed of sicknesses. Apparently some of these people, not just women I don't think, were wealthy people, and they underwrote Jesus' ministry. It tells us that. Luke chapter 8, verse 3. So there's money coming in. And Judas somehow ends up being in charge of it and holding the bag. As time goes on, I believe, and this is my imagination, that, well, it's not really my imagination, because John says this happened. Apparently Judas begins to pilfer from the bag. John tells us that he stole from the bag, so I'm not guessing at this. And he's pilfering from the bag a little more and a little more, and unknown apparently to the people who are giving the money or to the other disciples. Time goes on, and Jesus is not making any moves toward becoming king. In fact, he hears these same things that the other disciples hear about. He must go and he must die and this and that. And that doesn't sound like really what he was signing up for. He's looking for a king. Miracle after miracle happens in his anticipation of Jesus being king and him being up high on the ladder there, become greater and greater. But meanwhile, he's having the issues with some of these other guys. Every time he turns around, there's Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John this, Peter, James, and John that. What about me? He sees their mother, James and John's mother, talking to Jesus, and just as he suspected, she's over there put in a good word for her boys. Right? Can my boys be your right, one on your right hand and one on your left? These want to say, shut up, woman, and get out of here. And these nasty kids that are around that Jesus is talking about, and these filthy, disease-ridden people, I don't want to touch them. Lepers? But he's enduring it for the end, isn't he? The time comes in our text when it's Passover week and they are there and there is a huge crowd of people doting over Jesus, hanging on his every word. And they're there for several nights, and at nighttime Jesus and his crew leave the town and go out into the countryside a little bit, a lot of times over the valley on the Mount of Olives, and stay there. And as the thing builds and builds, and Judas just knows that tomorrow is going to be the day that Jesus is going to march in. He doesn't need an army. He can work miracles. He's going to cast aside the Roman rulers and set himself up as king, as Messiah. The people are ready for it. And he turns and looks, and Jesus, over there on the Mount of Olives, Jesus is crying. Crying. Crying over Jerusalem. Jerusalem, why wouldn't you receive me? And Judas is saying, gosh, what a bunch of losers. This is it. I'm out of here. He's had thoughts already about betraying Jesus because not enough money is coming in to satisfy him. So he decides, it's over. It's over. I'm cutting my losses. It's over. Judas. I wouldn't name my dog that. Much less my kids. Might be a good name for a cat. I said that for you, Gina. Let's get to our life. You ever cut your losses? I'll tell you four or five instances. And I don't have anybody in most of these particularly in mind. You might think I do. But everybody here knows somebody that could fit into one of these illustrations. First one I want to tell you is about a guy that is particularly about somebody. Last week, this was last week, when Dalton Lynn was here. Y'all remember him? The guy that's on staff at UCA working with student mobilization and discipleship ministry. Well, spiritually, and this is spiritually, the generations of spiritual reproduction, right? You remember he quoted the verse that he says that Paul told Timothy, Timothy, the things that you have learned from me, commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also. Now there's four generations, Paul, Timothy, faithful men, and others. Everybody following that line? Okay. You lead somebody to Christ, you disciple them, generation after generation. Well, Dalton Lynn, if you could go back in his spiritual generation, I don't know how many generations, and a generation can happen in a year or two or less, but probably six or seven generations, maybe 15 generations, I don't know. But there was a man, or at that time he was a young man, a student, in Fayetteville. And I was there and I knew him. All right, I knew Dalton's ancestors in the Lord, you might say. And there was a guy there in that group of disciples, quote, disciples, who was walking with the Lord, who was being challenged to give his life forever to Christ and follow Jesus. Remember Dalton talked about summer projects that they went to? He had been to one for 9 weeks, Kaleo Project in Florida this past summer. They were doing those things then, just on a lot smaller scale, because the disciples mushroomed from the time I was there until now. It might have been 50 to 100 kids. Now it's thousands. Because they are making disciples. Well, here's a guy there, and he is being challenged to give his life to Jesus. And he was. He was leading groups. He was doing this. And I've told you this before, so some of you are going to recognize the story. But one day he came in to the leader of the group with the materials that he had, Bible study, Bible, whatever, and laid them down on the desk and said, I'm quitting. So the guy told me, that he told us who told me this. He told me with these words, the 70 years of my life that I can see outweigh the millions of years of eternity that I cannot see. And he set it down, cut his losses, and left. How do you think that guy felt? I'll tell you how I think he felt. I think a weight was lifted off his shoulders and he felt free. Because living for Jesus, for him, was a burden. Especially in an environment like he was in. And he cut his losses, and he gave it up, said, I'm out of here. It's gone. All of us could find somebody that we know. Maybe too close to not sting. Kids who are raised by Christian families, in church, walking with the Lord, their parents are committed Christians, and they are there in the vicinity and reaping the benefits of being in a Christian home. And they go to church because mom and daddy go to church. They can talk about Jesus because they've been taught about Jesus. But the day comes when they get grown and they leave home, and what happens? Their frequency at church becomes less and less and less. And the day comes when they quit trying to fake it and they say, I'm through. I'm through. I don't care anymore. I don't believe it anymore. It's over. How do they feel? I think they feel freedom. I think they feel a burden has been lifted from them. This one may sting worse. There are a man and a woman who are married. Like everybody, when they get married, they think that what on earth could ever drive us apart? What could ever go wrong? And it's not long before they find out what goes wrong. And yet, they know, well, yeah, I know, we've been told it's not going to be easy. You're going to have to work through this, work through that, all this. And they go about their merry way, becoming more unhappy and more unhappy all the time. They contemplate, contemplating leaving, getting divorced, but their conscience condemns them because they've been taught that is wrong. That is not the answer. But the day comes when they don't care anymore. They convince themselves that my kids will get over it. My kids won't be hurt near as bad as I'm telling myself that they will. Tell all of these things to themselves. Maybe even with these words, I don't care what God thinks about it. I've got to get some relief. And they can't cut their losses and they leave. Susan and I were in a church years ago. And one day, I shouldn't say out of the blue, because you could see this coming if you were looking at all. But one day the pastor left. I mean, left his wife and his kids and the church, and he left. He left his wife for another man. His last sermon was on the ninth commandment. You know what the ninth commandment is? Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Surprisingly, the application of his sermon was, don't believe all you're going to hear about me. All right? Kind of preparing you to put you on a guilt trip if you believe things that you might hear from him after he's gone. He left a wife and four kids and went and lived with a man. I followed him there and confronted him about what he's doing. Me and his wife. After being fed a yarn, which I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt, he's gone for 3 months or whatever, it comes to light that he too has been pilfering from the plate, been stealing money. Someone came to me with proof of it, and I again went to this time a different town because he had moved. Unannounced, went there and confronted him with that. Cutting his ties with everything that he knew to be right, and walking out and leaving. Lying about everybody who would call his hand at whatever it was. And today, I could carry you a mile down the road and show you his grave. He died a year or two after that, at the age of 35 or so, I'm not sure of the age, but one right in there, with AIDS. Thinking that he's going to be happy. Happy. Happiness is a sorry goal for your life. Being happy, that is not a good purpose to give your life to be happy. Because if you're living just to be happy, you're going to have to switch marriage partners ever so often. You're going to have to switch jobs. You're going to have to switch hobbies. You're going to have to switch this. You're going to have to quit that. Because somewhere along the line, sooner or later, lots of things are going to make you unhappy. And if you cut your losses every time one comes along, your life is not going to end what you're pursuing. You're not going to be happy. You'll have to have a new marriage. You'll have to have stronger drugs. You'll have to have something different to produce the same amount of happiness that you had yesterday. Judas swapped his happiness for 30 pieces of silver. That's, at that time, was about 4 months' worth of wages. He had spent 3 years with Jesus and traded it in to be paid for only 4 months of it. Let me give you a better thing to live for than money, than happiness, and fame and power. And it's a paradoxical thing. But what I think we ought to want to do, to give our lives to, is simply this: pleasing God. Pleasing God. Now, the paradox of that is most people think, God, you got to be kidding. What can be fun about that? God and all his rules and all of these things, don't do this, don't do that. If God has changed your heart, you will want to please God. Doesn't mean you will be perfect. Doesn't mean you will always please him. Doesn't mean you will never sin. But it means you will find joy in knowing him. Judas missed it. We're not through with his story, but he missed it. What about you? What's the direction of your life? What things are you pursuing? Let's pray.